Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 596, Science Faction, Statistics and Getting Horizontal.
Getting horizontal. Now, this is slowly becoming a porn podcast, and I'm not opposed to it.
I love that we're in such a sexualized culture that I could just literally give a direction, and like one of two main, like, or position, I guess, give a position, one of two main positions that you would think of, and yet that in itself is a sexual innuendo.
We're going vertical. Oh, this guy's freaky. This guy doesn't.
Yeah, that's right.
This guy's great leg strength. That's what that tells me. Doing it vertical.
My mom always told me to stay away from you diagonal boys.
Man, your core strength must be through the roof.
Sure, you're fun when we're in our 20s, but then later when we're in our 30s and 40s and you're out gallivanting around, we did it to ourselves.
Yeah, the isosceles fucking that we did really played hell on my back.
Oh, and speaking of hell on your back, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. With me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damien Mercado. Damien, how you doing this afternoon?
Doing great. Hell on your back sounds like a 1950s like Catholic propaganda against pornography.
Or sex in general.
Yeah, just like pro-abstinence education from Texas.
Or for some reason they took like very particular religious offense to auto mechanics who utilize creepers to get underneath cars in order to do oil changes.
You shimmy like a shrimp. Like God intended under that vehicle.
Shrimp, which if you know the Bible, you're not allowed to eat.
I'm also thinking like in that abstinence class, what if like some student, you know, we only give it to the girls. You only give it to, so like, what if the guy was on his back and then like the student gets slapped like right in front of.
They're not gay.
Nobody knows to have sex quite like a Christian. And it ain't something like that. I'll tell you, it ain't with a man on his back.
They're already getting some good feedback of putting our Patreon episode onto our main feed. We did that, I think, earlier today, and a bunch of people seem to dig that. Thank our Patreon so much for that, for sponsoring that episode and allowing us to then release it out to the public. And for those of you guys who want to get more episodes like that every single week, we do two episodes every single week, the second one with four science articles in it. So if you want to check that out, you can look up Robert Timothy on Patreon.
And if you're looking for another podcast and you're into tabletop gaming, I, along with several of San Diego's funniest people, have a podcast called Awful Neutral. It is a Dungeons & Dragons live play podcast. We play a lot of other games, too. It's a lot of fun if you're tired of learning shit on this one and just want to laugh a little bit more. And I think Alex Jones makes an appearance on that podcast, too. So Awful Neutral, check us out.
Yeah, but just don't ever, ever listen to, play, or participate in anything related to Dungeons & Dragons. All right, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
We have so much Alex Jones. Like, if you come here for the Alex Jones, we have so much Alex Jones on Awful Neutral. We're lousy. We're filthy. We're bad boys with science.
You know what? I think we have the proper amount of Alex Jones. It's like if I just had a great meal and there was like, man, well, that's just the right amount of paprika. And they're like, if you like that, you should go to this other restaurant where they dump like three times as much paprika. And I'm like, no, you're not understanding me. I got the right amount here. I don't want more than that.
Don't use paprika. Use like shots of whiskey as your thing. And so, Bobby, you're like, I've had two shots. I'm a father. I have to get home at night. But if you want to rage, if you want to stay up and rage, like the earth is ending, check out Awful Neutral. Dungeons & Dragons community is known for raging.
It is exactly like eating a dish with three times too much paprika.
You don't even fucking have taste buds. What do you care?
All right, article number one, success, failure, and statistics.
I'm only familiar with one of the three things you just talked about.
You do have that degree in stats.
I thought I'd use it more on this podcast. It just doesn't come up.
I like the idea that you'd be familiar with neither success nor failure. Like, you've gone through life setting no goals and meeting no criteria.
You could argue getting a degree in statistics is a form of success in some way. So I'm like self-taught in statistics.
Or you did something to balance it out where you're like, you didn't feel like a success because you're so much of a, you're exactly as equal a failure on something else.
I couldn't pay the last semester of tuition.
Balance in the teeter-totter. Like, you just...
I am the yin and yang of failure. Statistically, so improbable.
So this was a great article I came across on Science News. The thing that got me really interested in this is the fact that it addresses something that I have thought of in other words before, but these guys said much better and much more appropriately and explored.
You said it
much
in Klingon.
Yeah.
Nobody could understand.
I used a couple of ethnic slurs that are no longer appropriate.
To be fair, though, their language is like 90% ethnic slurs. It's a horrible, like, there are very few, they don't have a word for data, for N number, sample size.
And I'll be goddamned if I let those mix get away with it this time.
Wow, Bobby, that's a poor translation from Klingon.
So it's going to be a bit confusing at first, possibly, but I promise it's worth understanding because this is something that I find very, very interesting. And I think anybody who saw it with the right data points would go, man, this is actually super, super interesting. And as a stats nerd myself, this is something I have been interested in for a while. And it has to do with our evaluations of stuff and what we call, you know, like data analysis, or especially in things like epidemiology or demographics, what we're actually trying to analyze or measure in something. And when we try and do interventions and, you know, fields like sociology, when you then try and do those interventions, what it is you're seeking to intervene on and what you choose. And a lot of times what you say is, well, let's look at all the data sets. Let's see what, let's say all these people who are impoverished, let's see on average what they need. And then the bloom, 70% of them need this thing. Let's do that. And that's how we can best help those people. And the reality might be that assuming the average or assuming the mean is the best course of action doesn't always work in situations like that. So again, might seem a little confusing at first. Let's get into it. In general, our evaluation of anything is going to be based on some statistical data, and that statistical data's representation is usually geared toward a mean representing a data set. You might talk about other outliers or something, but in general, you're talking about a mean representing a data set. And so when we're talking about something as being a success or a failure, it is looked at in terms of whether that mean moves up or down. And most data is analyzed from that mean perspective. In fact, a lot of times, depending on how you're collecting data, entire data sets basically get conglomerated into a single mean, which is then, or average, which is then utilized to represent that entire data set for a bunch of other calculations you do in order to incorporate other data sets and stuff. So sometimes it's incredibly important because it becomes the only number by which you transfer into the next phase of the statistical formula. It depends on what you're doing and how rigorous you are.
A lot of undergrads quit, working with data sets that constantly make fun of their weight.
Yes.
Or just constantly chip away at them.
They're very mean data sets. Yes, yes. I see what you're saying.
Because I have a degree in statistics, I can make this joke.
You are an outlier.
What the fuck you call me?
In that you sleep outside and you lie a lot.
Yeah, me and my wife are fighting a lot. Yeah, yeah. I've been sleeping outside the last couple days. Yes. Not even my car. She has the keys to my car.
Yeah.
So I'm just outside in a sleeping bag. Damien. I wrestled a raccoon last night.
Be honest, Damien. You're not allowed inside the house by fire marshal order. And you know that is the case and it will not be rescinded.
Listen. We're tough, but we back the fire marshal badge.
There's
in our house.
There's a fumes issue.
we have a doctor on it. Dr. House is on it. I don't know what's going to happen.
You know, you can only sleep in a house that isn't occupied by any other living thing, including a canary. Ironically enough, canary in the coal mine, actually illegal.
I'm not allowed to be around an open flame, even if it's outdoors.
I mean, technically, there's open flames everywhere outdoors, if you think about it, somewhere on Earth, so you just can't go outside.
That's right, too. So you want me to kill myself, Fire Marshal? I get it. I've been looking for an excuse, and now that the state is kind of backing one.
So why is it that that might be short-sighted? Now, sometimes, by the way, I should start off by saying this. In stats, a lot of times, data sets can be congealed down to a mean, depending on what it is that you are trying to do, if you're trying to do basic statistics. A lot of times, a mean is the most important thing, and there's no reason we look at it. It's not like it's completely irrelevant. In fact, it's not even like it's not the most important thing to look at. But in terms of determining success or failure of any given experiment or intervention or anything like that, it might be true that the mean isn't the only thing you have to look at. Now, I am simplifying, obviously, in, you know, research papers, the mean isn't the only thing. They'll look at differences in the standard deviation and, you know, how we see different changes and stuff. But what this Science News article suggests, and something that I have thought of quite a bit in terms of stats, is what if that focus on the mean is actually obscuring not only a lot of data, but a lot of interventionalist possibilities that we don't see aggregated across the whole. So what this paper talks about is basically deviance, the outliers, the ones that are able to be on the tail ends, you know, many standard deviations or z-scores away from that mean. Because a lot of times that, the ones that are successful especially, are what we need to be focusing on as opposed to what's going on necessarily in the mean average. And there's a lot of reasons for that. We'll get into a few of them. So this is referred to as positive deviance, meaning something that is outside the norm, but it leads to success in whatever it is that you're trying to do.
Like if you had to guess average penis size in America,
mm-hmm.
or average penis size, you can't really make successful porn with the average penis size. But if you focus in on the deviance on both ends of the spectrum,
yes,
that's where the best film, that's where the art is.
Yeah, that's right. We all know that tiny penis porn that is raging through the internet.
To be honest, it's actually made by the powerful small penis lobby to help reassure. It's put out like propaganda, like Fox News, to help small penis men think that like they're with the pack. You know, they're with everybody else.
You know, it'd be a great Kaiser Soze moment is if we found out there was like one tiny penis porn star, and he was it. Like he was the superstar of the tiny penis porn world, and he was the only guy super into it. And if you ever looked up tiny penis porn, it was only this guy basically doing it. And everybody was like, "Man, this must have this is interesting that you know like nobody else is doing it." And then it turns out there's absolutely no market. Nobody wants to see tiny penis porn. Yeah. But this guy is actually a porn producer who grew up getting made fun of for his tiny penis. They wouldn't allow him to work in porn. He became a porn producer, started his own porn mega company, and then just started this whole front so that he could then become the world's only tiny penis porn star.
He's the Logan Paul of or Jake, whatever the boxing one is. Who creates his own market. It's like that scenario you described, by the way, is a lot like that Chris Farley Chippendale sketch from Saturday Night Live years ago.
Yeah.
Like, you know, turns out there's really no market for a fat stripper. Like, turns out nobody wants to see a small penis in action.
Oh, dear. He didn't even have the limp. That was fake, too. It was crazy.
He had CP, you piece of shit.
So the hypothesis of this article is that we should stop being dependent on average of group numbers and look at the successful individuals, the deviance, and figure out what they're doing. These successful strategies may work well for the average person, meaning that if we can, instead of looking at a trend in the average, look at trends that are at the tail ends that show to be successful, then determine what those people are doing to be successful and see if it can either be directly adapted or somehow alternately adapted to the average person use. That might be a better success than what we do, which is put out some kind of intervention. We see it moves the mean a little bit, and then we go, okay, well, it must be successful. Well, that could be a very small number of people, especially if it's geared towards the mean. Remember, if an intervention is geared towards the mean, it is only hitting, you know, what is right there in the middle of that bell curve. And you might think that represents everybody or the most people, but in fact, it doesn't. It represents a very narrow portion of people. It just happens to be the narrow portion of people who happen to be right in the middle of the exact amount of equal people on either side of them. But it doesn't mean that they're any more or less like them necessarily. So that means if you gear everything towards the average, you will see that average move because you are gearing everything towards it. But it doesn't mean you're doing the most good. Sometimes the most good in terms of sociological or epidemiological or something, some kind of intervention, can be done by acting on the tail, specifically looking at what's successful in the highest percentage of successful people and finding a way to adapt that, not to the average, but to the bulk of the people underneath it.
In your head, as you're saying this, I'm picturing this, the analogy being done with penises. You know, like if we want average penis size to go up, yes, we could just give the average American bigger boost. But how about why don't we focus on the smaller end of the spectrum?
Well, look, so the article gives some really good examples. One of them is like there's Vietnamese farmers and there's some people who get brought in from outside to do an intervention because there's some serious health issues. The young children, the babies are not eating nearly enough. They're underweight, et cetera, all the stuff that comes with that. And it's because of like a kind of nationwide famine. It's hitting everybody. But they ask these interventionalists to be like, hey, look, can you look around, figure out some data and find a way to help? And they looked at it. They said, yes, look, on average, everybody's just doing worse. We can see this all going down. I forgot if it was a drought or a flood or something, but they're like, look, everybody is doing pretty badly. But what they also did was they went around, they looked, well, look, this tail end, these top like 2% or something of these groups are actually doing well. You know, they didn't just, you know, not lose ground. They actually gained it. They're doing pretty well. What is it that they're doing differently? And then went and examined those people. And it just so happened they found out that those particular people were eating these like little crabs and shrimp and feeding them to their kids that are found in the like rice paddy canals, but they're kind of considered taboo. And so most of the village didn't eat them, but these people just decided to. And so their kids were well fed because they got to eat all of the time. And so the intervention was to take what was successful for that tiny percentage of people and then find a way to adapt it to everybody else by trying to get over those taboos by instituting cultural norms and then showing them that it's, you know, helping the kids and the benefits and blah, 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 blah. And then eventually changing behavior in the mass group. But you do so with an initial focus on that tail end of success.
Meanwhile, the guy who had cornered the market on sweet river crabs and shrimp, and now everybody's his fishing hole's ruined thanks to these selfish scientists.
So again, I don't know if I explained this well, but one of the things to take away is a lot of times in stats, things get reduced down to an average, and we talk about successes or failures as to whether or not that average moves. Well, especially if you're talking about interventions geared towards an average, a lot of times you can move that average, and all that means is you are affecting a narrow band in the middle and moving them over a little bit, but you're not necessarily affecting the most people just because you're having a big effect on the average. And if instead, maybe you focus on those tail ends and find the strategies of success. And I would advise, by the way, you also focus on the negative tail ends and find the strategies of failure and you use those as something to purposely avoid. But you find the strategies of success in that tail end and you use those to apply to not the average, but basically everybody else underneath them.
I'm sorry, Bobby, I got lost in tail end. What was that? Was there twerking at the end of the article? I think there was twerking. That's all I thought about.
So they even brought up an interesting like example of this, which is that in 2011, in the Journal of Telemedicine and Telecare, they showed that in 29 separate studies, automated recordings or text messages increased attendance of patients to a doctor's office by 29%. But then when another research team looked at the actual medical records for like 64,000 low-income patients, who tend to, by the way, miss like almost half of their appointments in general, that exact intervention, the robocall followed by a text message, did not increase the attendance whatsoever, not a bit. And they knew that for sure because they could actually look at the medical records and see when somebody showed up to that doctor's office. What they were pointing out was that these types of interventions are often targeted at the average patient. They went, look, if we look at all these studies, we are showing that on average, this impacts people. Well, one, that can kind of focus in on broad middle-class groups that aren't necessarily representative of other demographics that fall along the same spectrum. And so you keep calling and texting because it worked on like rich white chicks going to their doctor's appointment, and it's not necessarily going to work on like a person of color who is 19 and lives in an urban center. And not being able to ascertain the difference between the two comes from a dependence on using the mean as a standard by which we measure success and failure.
Unfortunately, what this meant is that in a lot of red states, they just entrusted reminding appointments to law enforcement. If you lived in a poor person of color neighborhood, federal agents will kick in your door and collect data and plant drugs.
And one way to think about that in terms of like your own life, how do you implement it as a strategy, is like one of the things that you can see is one of many methods to be successful isn't to necessarily say, hey, how is the way most people learn this skill I want to learn or become successful at this thing I want to be successful at? You might not necessarily want to look at how most people do it. You might want to look at how the outliers do it. And assuming, by the way, that these outliers aren't there because they are particularly lucky or set up because they have a trust fund or, you know, they possess some great physical skill you could never have. Like assuming that what they did is an achievable feat for you to also try and do. If you can mimic what is successful for other outliers, then maybe you could also be one of those outliers. And if everybody does it, maybe then the whole bell curve moves up.
Yeah, that you can't have some limitation. I think my whole penis analogy falls apart right at the end. Like, it was showboating on its way to the end zone and fumbled.
All right, article number two, HGT-driven evolution.
I'm picturing a Joe Rogan-esque, like, dinosaur or a monkey.
Okay.
Like, talking about DMT. And it's jacked. Like, this is a jacked-ass primate.
All right, gotcha.
It's also kicking boards, which is really difficult for a primate to do.
Okay. I'm imagining, like, a very proper, very waspy white dude whose initials are HGT, and he has them on a monogrammed lapel napkin that is hanging properly out of his pocket. And he's driving in a 2005 Mitsubishi Lancer Evolution. It's raced to the gills, like he's in Fast and the Furious.
Okay, because HGT, which is human growth hormone, right?
No, horizontal gene transfer.
Oh, okay.
Literally missed every word.
That's fine, because actually this works out even better. HGT, that's like home and garden television. I picture Ina Gardner showing us how to make sangria.
So there's a really great article on Science Daily right now about horizontal gene transfer and its role not only in history in the past and stuff, but in evolution itself. So let's go over horizontal gene transfer, what it is, how does it work, et cetera, et cetera. So horizontal refers to the genes actually being swapped among living creatures, as opposed to vertical, meaning somebody inherits their genes from their ancestors above them. And how does this work? Well, bacteria can come in and switch around genes amongst themselves. We've known that for a long time. We know that horizontal gene transfer plays a huge role in bacterial evolution, especially antibiotic-resistant bacteria, where one bacteria can get antibiotic-resistant genes, and you don't have to wait until it has descendants and descendants and descendants. It can literally team up with the bacteria next to it, swap those genes, and then make that bacteria antibiotic-resistant too. So it can just, you know, horizontally transfer that throughout any kind of community. And that is one of the reasons bacteria can, you know, kind of do amazing things and do them very quickly.
We talked about horizontal gene transfer before, but I think it's been a bit now, it's rusty. So I want to go back to when I thought you were referring to human growth hormone.
Yes.
Way to just roll with the punches, because like that was just nonsense. And you didn't miss a beat.
Well, especially because it's not even the right letters. That would be HGH.
I'm going to be honest with you, Bobby. I can't read or write.
But that, by the way, that would be an incredibly impressive thing, because you have made it quite far, you illiterate bastard.
I have conned so many people. I have a master's in business, which is the perfect. If you are a con man, that is the master's degree for you.
And it also happens when viruses can infect us and actually trade genes with us. We've talked on this show before about viruses, especially we call them retroviruses, infecting us and actually inserting genetic material into our own DNA. But it works both ways. They can also take parts of either animal or plant DNA and those genes and take them into their own viral genome. And that part happens way more than we thought. In fact, it seems to be the biggest transfer of genetic material is from the plant or animal host to the virus, not the other way around.
What percentage of our junk DNA is just crap that a virus unloaded on us and didn't...
just stashed in there? I don't know. That's a good point. Probably quite a bit. And some of it is very useful, functional DNA. We talked about it on this show before. It was actually a viral infection and insertion into DNA that created the genes for the placenta that made mammals possible. So literally, all mammals exist because of this process and a virus's ability to pick up, clip out, insert, take out, copy DNA inside of us.
When it goes into our DNA, does it steal that feature, or is it just copy it for itself?
Yeah, and it's almost never the feature, right? Because the same gene that does something for us is probably going to do something very different in them because of the way they, you know, do stuff, and so it likely won't. Sometimes there are ways to get around our immune system, and that's what the virus is doing, is like picking out little things that it can then use. It is very, very interesting. It is also, by the way, one of the reasons that one of many reasons, like all the GMO hubbub is bullshit. It's like, you can't take genes from one plant or animal and put them in another, and it's like, bitch, that's been going on since the beginning of time. It's called horizontal gene. It's actually more common than not in bacteria for them to have experienced horizontal gene transfer. It's not even rare. What are you talking about?
And we at Greenpeace oppose that too. It's not just you we hate. It's viruses.
And by the way, we have evidence of it where like a virus can literally snatch some genes from one creature and put it into a different species. And some of that is how we can actually sometimes trace when viruses crosses those animal to human and back to other animal boundaries. One of the ways we can tell sometimes is actually the remnants that are left either in the virus itself or in the animals that it's gone through. So yes, we get genes from other things. We get them from viruses. We get them from things viruses have taken them from, and viruses take them from us and from other things as well. And that is always going on. And the interesting thing is that is going to affect the evolutionary fitness of animals in some cases. Again, we talked about most of the genome not being non-coding, so most of this probably wouldn't directly have an effect, but some of it will, and on a big enough timeline, a big enough time scale, with enough, you know, with the whole Earth involved, you're going to have some significant impacts to the history of evolution because of horizontal gene transfer, not least of which was the creation of mammals.
Do you think, like, viruses now are trying to pull off the ultimate gene heist, like something to get people to sneeze all the time? Like, we'll just become a very sneezy species. That's the, that's like stealing the Mona Lisa of viruses. That's the, because if we're sneezing more, I imagine that'd be good for virus evolution. I'm sorry. That's all I had. And we at Greenpeace, by the way, are, I'd like to call a temporary truce with this show as a representative of Greenpeace, just to know that if viruses have a, now that they've made the list, do they have some Nazca lines we could fuck with?
Yeah, and, you know, these might be responsible for huge genetic leaps that end up becoming successful. Now, keep in mind, most big genetic leaps will end up being failures. In fact, most times the fetus won't even be viable, that creature won't even be born, but every once in a while, some tiny percentage of them will be hugely successful, and who knows where those genes came from, except we might have gotten them from a virus, as a virus took them from us, and who knows what our genes might be doing in some, like, monkey or something. God knows some of the stuff from COVID, maybe that got transplanted into to a bunch of the tens of thousands of mink they killed in, like, Northern Europe.
Because of COVID, yes.
Yeah.
And they burned them, all those coats.
Yeah.
Like, or is there, like, or did they just, or did somebody just be like, yes, I will burn this one, do not worry, then just buried it, and then, like, has this heist, like, I'm going to come back with the great mink coat heist. I'm sorry, I've been watching a lot of Ocean's 11, Bobby. I'm on a heist kick.
No, but I bet you we could get a nice side hustle going where we go dig some of these minks up. And you're not going to make them into coats now. I mean, obviously, they've degraded and stuff. They're nowhere near that. But, you know, what you can turn them into is things rich guys use to light their cigarettes with. Like, you know how, like, a rich guy in a movie will light a $100 bill on fire and use that to light his cigar, right? Well, $100, that's not much to a rich guy, but a mink, like, you know, some percentage of a mink coat that you're just lighting up to light your cigar?
That's brilliant, because, like, it just needs to look like a mink coat to everybody else until the point it's lit. So we can just spray paint stuff, spray paint a mink.
Yeah. Quick, get the domain name minkstoburn.com. Ooh, do .org. We'll do it as a nonprofit.
Everything's on the table. We'll have a super PAC.
Thank you, audience, for coming back for Science Faction 596, where you learned all about success, failure, and statistics, and how horizontal gene transfer could be a huge driver of evolution. Thank you so much for joining us, and come on back next week for Science Faction 597.
Hey, it's me, Alex Jones here. Sorry I would have been here sooner, but somebody put exactly three times as much paprika in my chili, and it really agitated my lung gout.
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.